This is KUNC's The Spotlight, our weekly hour featuring the best public radio that doesn't quite fit anywhere else. This week, we bring you The Cabinet of Curiosities, an omnibus featuring stories from our reporters at KUNC and friends from around the country that celebrate the creepy, the spooky, and the macabre just in time for Halloween. I'm Ryan Thompson, your guide through The Cabinet of Curiosities. For the next hour, we'll explore haunted cemeteries, monstrous workshops, and impromptu seances. We begin where else? But a prison. Producer Sarah Boothroyd takes us on an audio tour of a place few souls dare tread.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, maybe 15 cells on my left down a hallway.
Large, dark gray stone building. High walls surrounding it. The windows, very much like prison cell windows, even on the outside, the rounded tops, the bars.
It's been left. It's almost pristine in its history.
When you have a place that's been incarcerating prisoners for 130 years, there's an accumulation of human dust there.
You're in a place where there was a lot of suffering, a lot of trauma. And it has that resonance to it still.
There were dozens of people who were killed in that jail. There's hundreds of bodies buried around that area.
That building, more than most, has that sense of the past.
The feeling of being in that cell, entombed within solid granite. The walls are smooth. There's nothing to even hook onto because of fear that you might hang yourself. All you see is the shaft of light you may see from your bars.
Standing inside one of the cells. It's very narrow. It's about 3 feet wide. It's only about 8 feet long. And it has a rounded ceiling, with an interesting echo sound to it.
Those are leftover memories of people's lives.
The site of the last public hanging in Canadian history. The location for one of the great acts of misjustice in the history of Canada.
Thomas D'Arcy McGee was one of the founders of Confederation.
He just returned to
Parliament. Gave a fiery speech in the House of Commons.
When he finished speaking, he wrote a note to his daughter back in Montreal, explaining that he would be home on Sunday because it was his birthday. As it happened, he arrived home on Sunday for his funeral.
He left the House of Commons at about 2 a.m.
Snow on the ground. On his own. Shuffling along on his cane very slowly.
And as he bent down to open his door, somebody put a pistol to the back of his head and shot him.
It's maybe 6 feet long. I can see the brick right through it.
Places have a soul of their own.
Yeah, there's a few cracks in the wall. On the left side, too, there's a 3-foot crack and a 4-foot crack. They look like lightning bolts. And the floor is kind of a dark red color.
The location for one of the great acts of mischief.
Lying on his back. McGee's hat is still on. His cane is caught underneath him.
Within 24 hours, they'd arrested Patrick James Whelan.
5-day trial. There were paid witnesses.
Prime Minister turned up to sit on the dais beside the judge.
Great deal of pressure to convict.
He declared again and again that he was not guilty, but he wasn't free to say who was, because of threats to his family. The last few weeks of his, very angry, very frightened.
The night before, Whelan is in his cell. He's visited by the Sisters of Mercy. He's then allowed a brief visit by his wife, Bridget. The gallows itself is about 30 steps away from where he is sleeping.
This is the gallows. There's an iron barred door. And then behind that is a regular door with glass window pane in it. And then behind that is yet another barred door.
He's roused. It's cold, very cold February. Given a final meal, brought down the steps.
They've hung a noose.
The executioner went out first to test the trap.
The prisoner stood on the doors.
The hood is dropped on him, the noose is put around, and very quickly...
dropped 9 feet into eternity.
Right through those doors.
About 3.5 minutes to 7.5 minutes he took for him to die. He was suffocated, he was strangled. James Patrick Whelan was buried within the grounds of the Nicholas Street Jail.
The body would be buried immediately, would not be given back to the family. Whelan had been assured it would be.
Sarah Boothroyd at the Nicholas Street Jail in Ottawa. You can listen to more of Sarah's work at her website, sarahboothroyd.com. There's something about cemeteries, especially when they're old, like Denver's 136-year-old Riverside Cemetery. With Halloween fast approaching, KUNC's Nathan Heffel, along with a handful of other brave souls, recently toured the city's oldest operating cemetery at night. But not for the reason you may think.
Other than a few hints of moonlight peering through the clouds, a flashlight is the only source of light that we have on this tour. Statues of angels and obelisks that seem perfectly normal during the day take on an unworldly quality in the setting.
If there's a mean, nasty ghost in this cemetery, it's right here.
Tour guide Raymond Thal takes us to the grave of Lester Drake. Drake was a pioneer of the early mining settlement that would eventually become Blackhawk. He died in 1889, and his headstone is a massive hand-carved limestone replica of a mining cabin.
When they were unloading this, they brought it out and on a wagon, but it evidently fell, and it fell on the sculptor, and he was injured to a degree that he didn't survive it.
But Lester Drake is just one of the 67,000 people buried here in an industrial neighborhood on the east side of Denver. Other names may sound a bit more familiar for the history buffs, names like Tabor, Evans, Elitch, and Rout. Inside the cemetery's quaint one-room chapel, Patricia Carmody pages through one of a dozen massive, well-worn leather books.
Sometimes it'll give you a reason why they died. It might say gunshot or appendicitis.
Carmody is director of the Fairmount Heritage Foundation, a preservation group. For the past 11 years, they've been working to preserve the diminishing legacy of Riverside.
But they have different notations in here that really make you wonder what that person's life was like, what brought them here.
But this once prestigious Denver cemetery has largely been forgotten over time. The grass has long died away. Many gravestones are dilapidated and some neglected. And when the freight trains pass by every 30 minutes, it's loud enough to literally wake the dead.
It's location, location, location. I mean,
Raymond Thal is one of Riverside's many volunteers and a local Denver historian.
I mean, unless you're lost or a truck driver, you don't come by here.
Riverside was designated a National Historic District in 1994 for its significance to Colorado's pioneer history. And the Fairmount Heritage Foundation is operating the site as an educational center with programs designed to highlight the area's ongoing historical research and environmental preservation.
Are you ready for your history mystery tour?
Which brings us back to why there's a group of 20 people who paid $15 to tour Riverside in the dark. Beverly Gravinsky is another volunteer tour guide.
Have you ever heard of the word tapophile? It means lover of cemeteries. I guess I'm a tapophile.
Gravinsky, wearing an orange witch's hat, has an animated way of telling the history of Riverside. It's infectious, especially when she's explaining one of the many mysterious gravestones.
We've got our beloved mother, born August 7th, 1827, died May 22nd, 1889. It's huge. It's expensive. There's nobody in it. There's no record of this plot being sold. They don't know how this got here, why there's nobody in it. This, what they thought was Mary Elitch was quite the prankster. And she had an ostrich. And it is believed the ostrich's name was Holden. And that she came out and put her ostrich inside.
It's stories like that that brought out Denver native Jenna Gilbert and her friends on her birthday.
Of course, we're close to Halloween, but also the historical preservation of cemeteries, especially this part of town, I think is important.
As we head back to the chapel, tour guide Raymond Thal is quick to point out, well, there's a lot of history at Riverside. There's also a few spooky stories as well.
And the guy that works here and has worked here for over 30 years, he's got many tales of hearing things, or the baby cries on certain nights of the year. Oftentimes people will see a woman in a white dress, which, again, I think probably every cemetery in the country has a woman in a white dress.
That was KUNC's Nathan Heffel reporting from Denver's Riverside Cemetery. Coming up on the Cabinet of Curiosities, a group of friends gather for a birthday party. And then
an idea popped in my head, and I thought, hey, there's nothing else going on here tonight. Why don't we do a seance?
What could go wrong? Find out when the Cabinet of Curiosities continues.
Starting to talk.
You're listening to The Cabinet of Curiosities on KUNC's The Spotlight. I'm Ryan Thompson. Our next tale comes from KCRW's Unfictional. On a summer night, a small group of friends gather for a dinner party in Los Angeles. Just for fun, someone suggests having a séance. What happened next was nothing they could have anticipated.
A long time ago, in my native country of France, my best friends would sometimes leave for a year or two at a time and go to foreign countries. And that particular year, in the beginning of the 80s, they came back with mystical knowledge, having been exposed to mysticism and spirituality. And they had brought that back to our posh Parisian suburban neighborhood. And we were all around 12, 13, 14, and we started the habit of doing seances. Our Wednesday afternoons, when we were free from school, were spent gathering around the table and calling on spirits. There was no toy store in France where you would find a Ouija board, so we would line up Scrabble letters and cut up a piece of paper that would say yes and one that would say no, and basically improvise a Ouija board. We would turn a glass upside down, we'd put our fingers on top of the glass, and then you concentrate real hard, and you close your eyes and nothing is said. And then you start to feel a little tug and a little pull. You can feel a little bit of a movement, of an energy, that is completely independent. So the glass moves across the table, makes a noise, and goes to a letter, then another. It takes a while. It's like time kind of suspends itself. And lo and behold, the glass started spelling out words, and we'd get messages, and sometimes they were silly, sometimes they were threatening. Sometimes we would ask, when is the end of the world going to come? What are the winning numbers of the Lotto? Something which we never got, by the way. And that became sort of our primary hobby for a while. Calling on spirits. Fast forward to the beginning of the 90s, and my friend Christy is having her birthday party.
It was a combination birthday party and going away party, being thrown by my girlfriend Jennifer for me. It was at her house in L.A. I was actually leaving L.A. and going to college in Arizona. I just didn't want to be in L.A. anymore.
The only two people I know there are her and our friend Deborah.
Christy and I have been good friends since high school. She has been one of my best friends for years. The party was in an old craftsman's house in Hollywood. Just so you know, I have a very bad memory and I don't remember very much, but I do remember very clearly a lot of this event.
The party was a hodgepodge of various individuals.
My girlfriend Becky was one of my roommates. Becky's boyfriend, Mike, he was a Malibu sheriff. Then there was Mark, the Frenchman, and my girlfriend Debbie. Then my boyfriend Danny, and he was the rocker.
The party really wasn't going anywhere. In France, when we had a party, the idea was drink as much as you can, as fast as you can, and then put on James Brown's Sex Machine. Unfortunately, there was no James Brown available that night, so we had to think of something else. And I started to wander off into the dining area, and there was a huge oak table. And in the back, there was an armoire and a bunch of crystal glasses. And an idea popped in my head, and I thought, hey, there's nothing else going on here tonight. Why don't we do a seance?
I've never really taken these Ouija boards seriously. I kind of thought, whatever, we'll do it. I think in high school, maybe we tried it a couple times, but nothing really ever happened. So I didn't take it seriously and didn't really think anything of it.
It kind of just struck a chord that it would be something fun and different to do. I mean, I'm spiritualist. Like, I believe in God, but I don't believe in Ouija boards. I just thought it would be fun to just mess around. I wasn't taking it seriously. I didn't believe in that type of thing at all. So we lit some candles and turned on some, you know, Enya, and just kind of played around.
We cut out a bunch of letters, you know, to create the alphabet, put them around the table in a circle. There was a piece of paper that said yes and a piece of paper that said no. And we took a crystal glass with a stem and turned it upside down and put it in the middle. You know, everybody quiet down and closed their eyes. And I don't know if we are the antennas. I believe we are. And I believe that the glass ultimately is just a vessel, and it allows psychic energy to concentrate at the center of it. For those of us who had their fingers on the glass, and I think at the time it was Christy, Deborah, me, and someone else, we started to feel, after a very short amount of time, actually it was uncanny how quickly it started, we started to feel that very familiar little tug.
It was a little bit thrilling, like, ooh, what is this? I remember my hair kind of raising up, thinking, what could this be?
You have the sensation that something is connecting with the glass and then trying to find its bearings. It's very distinctive. If you've done this a few times, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
And then after a while, it started kind of getting a flow and a rhythm, and it started kind of moving in an eight, like a shape of an eight, and back and forth, and it was very rhythmic, but it was flowing and very smooth suddenly.
Of course, the skeptics immediately thought, you're moving the glass. And I would say, no, I'm not moving the glass. And a good way to take care of the skeptics is to command the glass to do geometric forms. For example, I would tell the glass to spin in a circle. You tell the glass to go faster and faster and faster, and let me tell you, that thing flies. It's so fast. And you would still have people going, oh, yeah, you're moving the glass. And I would say, no, you try. Every time the glass would tip over. You cannot coordinate four people that don't know each other, have not rehearsed this, and get a glass to move this fast. It's impossible. At that point, everybody went, huh, what's going on? One of the guests at the party was an ex-stripper whose boyfriend was part of Malibu's law enforcement, and he said, no way, I don't believe this. You know, here, how old is my girlfriend? And the glass spelled out 29. Everybody went, well, see, that's not true. We all know she's 26. See, I told you, this is bull. Yeah, it was bull. Except for the girl in question, who admitted at that very moment that, in fact, she had been lying about her age by 3 years all this time and was indeed 29. Now that it was clear that something was moving the glass other than ourselves, one of us asked, who's here?
And started going back and forth to the letter K-I-K-I, or K-E-K-E. I can't remember how it spelled it.
And everybody asked, who's Kiki? And Christy, who was at the head of the table in front of me, just froze. I hadn't ever seen her like that. And she looked down at the table and she said, I know who's here.
I knew it was Brian. Brian had been my boyfriend for about 2.5 years, and he passed after committing suicide. When we were playing with this Ouija board, I was very skeptical. And even if you were to ask me today, I would still be a cynic. But the questions that we were asking were pretty, you know, standard and no big deal. I mean, anybody could answer the questions that we were asking. But the one thing that did stick out of my mind was it spelled out K-E-K-E, which is Kiki, which was my nickname that Brian called me just in private. That threw me for a huge loop. That is something that I don't understand to this day. Brian was my first love. I used to think about him every day. I still have not been able to look at pictures of him, but I can still see his face in my head. He was very good looking, had an amazing smile. He kept a tan better than anybody that I ever have seen. When he would walk into a room, everybody was drawn to him, and he was really funny, and he meant the world to me.
I think she was stunned. I think she was pretty shaken up, and I think she, you know, probably quite emotional about it because of the way things had ended.
Brian tried to commit suicide several times, and they put him in a little hospital, and then Christmas came, and I wasn't there, and I wasn't able to speak to him while he was in the suicide watch hospital. But I did find out that he got a belt and wrapped it around his neck and hung himself. A horrible way to die. And he was supposedly under supervision, and they were watching him, and somebody dropped the ball. I mean, I know that there's another dimension where our spirits go. It's just, I wasn't brought up to believe that that realm could interact with the present. I've just been raised in a very religious family, and so I really wanted to go back to my comfort zone, and that wasn't in my comfort zone. It really freaked me out.
Are you in heaven? The glass answered, no. Are you in hell? And the glass answered, no.
We asked him if he was in a place kind of somewhere in between. He said yes. And then Becky asked how long he was going to be there. And he said 27, which is the age he was when he killed himself.
Brian was a very lonely, sad person. But most people wouldn't realize that when they met him. So he was just going through a lot of things that probably most young men shouldn't have to go through. I find myself, like, sometimes, like, I'll get, like, a little tear in my eye, like when I was talking to you, and then I just wipe it away, and it goes away, it dries away.
Christy went to leave to go to the bathroom, and then it stopped moving. We asked this spirit, where'd you go? Did you go with Christy to the bathroom? And it said, yes. And we asked him, okay, if you were there with her, what color underwear was she wearing? And it spelled out, it misspelled it, but it said W-I-T-E, white. And sure enough, she was wearing white knickers.
Now, just behind Christy was another guest at the party who was her current boyfriend.
This kind of like glam rock guy sitting around the table, being really cool, not believing any of it.
I mean, what the hell? The ex is showing up uninvited at the birthday party and is getting all the attention. So he started to say, this is bull. And the glass immediately starts to move without having been asked a question. This is unusual. And spelled you. At which point, Christy's boyfriend replied, you.
And the cursor started spelling out his name, D-A-N-I, and then F-U. And it kept going back and forth, D-A-N-I-F-U. You know, you can fill in the blanks, but Danny got very upset.
Now, what's interesting here is that when you have to say something like, mother,
and you're speaking through a crystal glass as a spiritual entity, it takes a long time to spell M-O, etc., etc.
It was almost like sparring back and forth, and Danny was getting really upset, and sounds so silly. The Ouija board was getting really upset, which appears to have been Brian picking a fight, if you will, with Danny, my current boyfriend. It was very disturbing.
This is surreal. These two are having a cockfight in two different dimensions.
Danny was very hot-headed and very upset and ended up walking out.
My poor friend Christy was completely devastated. Meanwhile, the glass repeated several times, "I love you," and then, "I'm sorry."
This is kind of sad. I probably should have felt bad for my current boyfriend and think, you know, "Brian, don't say that. You're being a jerk." But I was just so almost frozen, just paralyzed inside my own head, thinking all these thoughts, you know, is this really him? Why did he die? How come nobody could help him? How much I missed him.
I think that because it was her birthday, we didn't really want to continue. So we said goodbye. And I remember my friend Deborah and I drove back to my house and didn't say a word on the way back.
Ever since that night, I have completely believed. I mean, to me, this was the most proof that there is something out there, more than what we can see and what we know. And it's definitely changed the way I see things. And I'm the biggest skeptic. I wouldn't believe this story if I weren't there, and I'm sure many people won't believe me, but it happened. And
I think the hardest part when somebody kills themselves is wondering why. And I feel like he just needed to be heard again, you know? I know this sounds crazy, but I believe he was talking to us. Me.
I think that what is important is to stay open-minded to what life may throw your way. Because so much of our life is framed by social convention, religion. We're sometimes quick to dismiss something as, "Nah, that didn't really happen." And I think there's a little danger in that. You know, you can become a ghost yourself. I think the beauty of his story is not that it is a ghost story, is that it's a love story. And that someone was able to reach beyond the divide and tell someone, "For the last time, I love you." Even Romeo and Juliet didn't get that.
Was produced by Bob Carlson and originally broadcast on KCRW's Unfictional. When the Cabinet of Curiosities continues, KUNC's Grace Hood takes us to a factory where they make something you don't see every day.
Thank you.
This is the Cabinet of Curiosities on KUNC, a collection of stories from around the public radio world to get you into the Halloween spirit. Jake Warga's job in his amateur ghost hunting group is to interview potential clients to determine if it's worth doing an actual, involved investigation of a house.
The first thing ghost hunters will do is what's called a walkthrough. A client will contact the group. Maybe they found the website or saw us on the Learning Channel. Stories vary. Maybe they're hearing strange noises upstairs or little things keep going missing. Sometimes they're at wits' end and are embarrassed, not knowing who to call. They won't call them crazy in return. A walkthrough is an initial assessment. Just a few of us meet with the client and determine if a location is worth an official investigation by the group. Usually an observer, a tech, and an interviewer. My position in the group, probably because I have a nice microphone, is to interview the client. Determine if it's worth coming back with loads of equipment, technicians, psychics, and spending hours crawling around long into the night. We did a walkthrough recently at a house west of Seattle. I always start with, who lives in the house? Claire is a 26-year-old female, occupation, mom. Husband, Rick, 27, carpenter. Son, Alex, is 2 years old. The house was built in 1919. They've been there 2 years. Neither are from the area. Claire has experienced numerous events, initially frightening her. She believes in ghosts. Rick does not, but confesses he can't find an explanation. All events happen at night. This is a pretty normal scenario. Women are more likely to believe in ghosts than men, and everything seems to happen at night. Both have heard a woman crying while in the back room. I ask if they know any of their neighbors very well, if one might be a woman prone to crying. They don't. They tell me about noises coming from upstairs, thumping like things dropping even though no one's up there. This is a classic one. She reports cold spots, sometimes with a brushing or touching feeling, when in Alex's room. Ghost hunters love it when people report cold spots because techs love taking the air temperature. She's also reported hearing a woman's whispering coming through the baby monitor. They don't know it, but baby monitors have been a ghost hunting tool since they were invented. I'm noticing a lot of activity focusing around the kid. I ask if the baby has ever done any odd things, like talk out loud to one specific spot. Claire seems surprised and a little frightened. Yes, she says. Sometimes he'll point to the ceiling and wave, hi, bye, followed by a noise upstairs. Even the husband has seen Alex do this, just points and says hi. A psychic once told me an interesting trick. Find a toddler and ask them, tell me about when you were big. She says that one in about eight will tell you about stuff they could not have known. Some say we're reincarnated each time we pass on, like sleeping, and waking. I ask Alex to tell me about when he was big, but he runs away looking embarrassed. He really only knows how to say hi and bye anyways. The trick is to find a child that has not yet been told that their imaginary friends are not real by the all-knowing adults, before their imagination has been replaced with television, before childhood amnesia kicks in, when they're still young enough to be sitting quietly in a corner and randomly giggle, before when we ask, what's so funny, they say, nothing, and continue with a more somber face. As adults, we find explanations for things that go bump in the night because our parents told us it was something other than what we first thought, a ghost, a monster. I get vibes sometimes when I walk in a room, and I feel like I've been watched while at home. I don't know why, but I think of a specific family member who's long gone. I wasn't thinking of them before. But as a rational adult, I brush it off. I'm a normal member of society because I ignore any sense other than my already untrustworthy five. My job as a ghost hunter is to be the adult. For example, Claire tells me that the incidences have all but stopped. Here's what I think. New mother, new wife, moves to a new town, far from her family. They don't know anyone, and a child is such an overwhelming thing for a new parent. And when there's a bump upstairs, all her fears come crashing down. I ask who she thinks it is that might be giving so much attention to Alex. Who whispers to him in his sleep? Who watches over him, and who he's so happy to see? My grandmother, she says. I so wanted her to see Alex, but she died before he was born. I think the occurrences have slowed because they're settled into a new neighborhood now. They've made new friends, home improvement projects going, including a white picket fence. There's less to be afraid of. She starts making grilled cheese sandwiches for dinner as we're on our way out. Claire notices me looking at one in a daze, wraps it up in a little sandwich bag and hands it to me. She's been a mother for 2 years now, a good one. I suggest in my report that we come back and do a proper investigation, concentrating on the kids' room. I instruct them to record the baby monitor. But if my hunch is right, it'll be too late to hear the cooing of a sweet grandmother when we play the tape back. It'll be too faint because she's not needed anymore.
At last I found the one I love, and you're the one I need. I always knew I'd find you someday. You're the sweetheart of my
That was Jake Warga reporting. To hear more of his work, visit jakewarga.com.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. My monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
Wow.
From my laboratory in the castle east,
wow,
to the master bedroom where the vampires feast,
wow, wow,
the ghouls all came from their humble to get a jolt from my electrodes.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
Wow.
The zombies were having fun. The party had just begun. The guests included Wolfman, Dracula and his son. The scene was rocking, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, backed by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five. They played the monster mash. It was a graveyard smash. It caught on in a flash. They played the monster mash. Out from his coffin, Drax's voice did ring. Seems he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said, whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash. And it's a graveyard smash. It's caught on in a flash. It's now the monster mash. Now everything's cool, Drax a part of the band, and my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them what is sent
then
you.
Can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And do my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash. Young boy.
If you've already visited a haunted house or plan to do so on Halloween, chances are you'll see something designed to scare you that's been created by Ed Edmonds.
That was the sound after a guy's head is cut off by a guillotine.
For more than 30 years, Edmonds has reinvented what's scary by designing props that make creepy sounds, spit, and shake violently inside haunted houses. The industry has changed dramatically in recent years, and so have Edmonds' ideas. KUNC's Grace Hood has more.
Our trip starts outside a nondescript warehouse in Greeley. There's no sign outside the Distortions building letting you know you're in the right place. Only a very squeaky door.
Grace, what's happening?
Hey. Just inside, in what looks like a front office, are five life-size zombies.
We got bloody zombies, we got fresh zombies, we got old zombies. And you can tell by the color and the amount of blood on them what they've been up to.
Edmund started his business back in 1978 when few things in the industry were mechanized.
And it was just mass at the time.
Then the company moved to props.
Well, everybody had cut-off hands. Well, we did cut-off arms. Now, that was big innovation back in the day.
Today, the company makes life-size props shipped to haunted houses across the country. These include installations that spring to life, shimmy, light up, shake violently, and in the case of this year's hottest item, rock in a chair?
Lullaby is this mother and baby. She's basically holding her baby, and she's dead, and the baby's dead. And they've been dead quite a while because they're pretty dusty and shriveled up. And that is the most popular product this year.
The company sold 1,300 so far, each one costing about $300. Stroll around Distortion's 22,000 square foot warehouse. Be careful where you step.
And so you have two cats on the loose.
Three cats on the loose.
Okay.
I don't know where the third one is.
You meet other characters, like the possessed.
She shakes, and she's made a mess on herself. She's thrown up, and of course it's green.
That's thanks to Poltergeist. You meet Buford, who spooks from his wheelchair.
Buford is this kind of like mutated hillbilly, and he's got a little stub arm, and he spits at you.
And there's one theme that never goes out of style.
You know, we've done so many electric chairs over the years that it's really getting tough to come up with names. You know, it's Jolt and Bolt and Electric Chair and Shake and Bake and Hot Seat. I mean, we've done all these different things, and pretty soon, you know, the thesaurus is, you know, it's getting a little thin.
We're heading into the basement, something that's typically a bad idea to do in horror films. Turns out something creepy does happen down here. It's where Buford, the possessed, almost all of the Distortion's characters are born. Workers pour latex and foam into molds of all shapes and sizes. Near the ceiling hang foam faces, hands, arms, and legs. Surrounding tables are piled with supplies and drying foam shapes. We take a sharp right and head past the racks of drying foam to visit a piece of Distortion's history.
This is the actual prop, the one that changed the industry, at least so they say.
Introduce us. Okay. Who is this?
This is the original electric chair. And this isn't only the original. This is the first one that went to the show.
An emaciated foam character sits strapped into a matte black chair. It's on top of a table, so it's at eye level. Back in 1996, Edmunds came up with the idea of mounting a 1-horsepower motor behind the chair. High tech at the time. A pulley system made the chair shake violently.
It would startle people because they say, okay, he's going to shake a little bit. And they would actually step back and, whoa, and laugh. And, you know, for a haunter, if it gets them on an emotional high, whether it's gross or scary or funny, it doesn't matter. It's any emotion. They know that that's going to be hot in their haunt.
Edmunds has hit a lot of home runs over the years. But for every home run, there's a strikeout, like zombie gunman.
When he shot, it lit up, and it was an air cannon. So it was like, boom, 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 boom. And I thought, that'll be great. What a flop. I don't even know if we sold one.
Compare that to a recent pièce de résistance vomit barrel.
Huge hit. Done at the 11th hour, just kind of as, okay, you know. And the stuff that we put a lot of time and thought into, some of it went, some of it didn't. So you never know.
In recent years, animatronics have become so pervasive in haunted houses that Edmunds and Distortions have gone old school and incorporated humans into their installations. It's called Shocktronics.
We've got one, in fact, I'm painting them today, that the body is upside down and it's shaking and there's electricity and these coils that go in and out. And then when it's all over, well, of course, there's a big scream and he comes rushing out. And let me tell you, haunters in broad daylight at these shows, it's very bright, will scream and run and fall.
That's something when you can scare a haunter. And it gets at the one thing that Edmunds has learned throughout his 3 decades of change and rapid growth in the industry. You never tell your audience what's scary. They tell you.
That was KUNC's Grace Hood, reporting from Distortions Unlimited in Greeley, Colorado.
Little shop of horrors,
The Travel Channel is documenting the work of Distortions Unlimited. You can catch the last two episodes in the series on Sunday night. We leave you now with David Terry of UNC Chapel Hill and producer Michael Kraskin. Maybe they can make some sense out of why we like a good scare.
From a narrative perspective, one of the most interesting things about ghost stories is the way that they relate to the 19th century genre of the detective story. And in many ways, the ghost story is the opposite of a detective story. A detective begins with facts, some of them being mysterious, right, and slowly, rationally, adds them up and figures out the solution to the puzzle. And so the end of the detective story is a solution. It's something that satisfactorily, intellectually brings all those things together. Now, the ghost story begins with whodunit, right? We already know that there was a crime committed, and the ghost in question was either the victim of the crime or was the perpetrator of the crime that keeps repeating it, either seeking repetition of the crime or some sort of retribution. The solution of a ghost story is the chill factor moment. Ooh! Right? When something happens that feels uncanny. You can't quite make sense of it, no matter how many times you go back over it. And even if you can try and construct something intellectual, that's always afterwards, right? The point of the ghost story is not an intellectual point at all. The point is, ooh! And storytellers, even smarty-pants academic storytellers, have begun using the model of the ghost story as a way of speaking to the things that we definitely non-cognitively know and sense about the world that we can't explain rationally. And the ghost story seeks a way to keep closure from happening, to keep something suspended. Right? Even when a ghost story is done, if it's good, then it still leaves you with a sense of, ooh, something might not be quite so right with the world. Something might still be a little bit off. If it doesn't do that, it's not very satisfying as a ghost story. But the end of a good ghost story still leaves you kind of wondering.
And with that, we close the Cabinet of Curiosities. I hope you enjoyed your tour. For KUNC, I'm Ryan Thompson. Have a happy Halloween, and sleep tight.